This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Inauguration Day, we're going to talk with two religious leaders who are on opposite sides politically and have different interpretations of the role of faith in politics. A little later, we'll hear from Reverend Jim Wallace, author of the new book, God's Politics, and editor-in-chief of Sojourners Magazine, which he describes as a progressive Christian publication. My first guest, Dr. Richard Land, is the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is the policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. President Bush appointed Dr. Land to two terms on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Last May, National Journal named Land one of the 10 church-state experts politicians will call on when they get serious about addressing an important public policy issue. Dr. Land also hosts the syndicated radio programs For Faith and Family and Richard Land Live. He says that evangelicals played an important part in re-electing President Bush. I asked him what they expect in return.
We're expecting him to keep his campaign promises. This president did not run a It's Morning in America campaign like Ronald Reagan did. He ran a very specific, policy-oriented campaign, laid out a whole series of proposals in his acceptance speech, campaigned on those issues, and said, if you reelect me, I will do this and this and this. And we expect him, and not only expect him, we're fully confident that he will. This is a conviction politician. This is a man who doesn't behave the way normal politicians do. Normal politicians would have made some sort of compromise on judicial nominees when the Senate kept unconstitutionally filibustering them and not giving them a vote before the full Senate. This president did not. He continued to send up judicial nominees that reflected his judicial philosophy, and he has now resubmitted every one of those nominees that would allow themselves to be renominated, which I believe was all but two. And he's going to continue to push for their confirmation, and I believe they will be confirmed, and that if this president lives out his full 8 years in office, if he is not killed or doesn't have to leave for illness reasons, he will have nominated and had confirmed more judges than any president in the history of the United States.
So what are the other issues you want to hold him accountable for? Conservative judicial nominees?
The pro-life issue. We want him to do everything he can to make this a pro-life administration and a pro-life government that protects and values every life from conception onward and welcomes all life. We want a president who will promote marriage. We strongly support his marriage reforms and the Welfare Reform Act, the single thing that would eliminate more poverty than any other single thing that could be done in this country would be if fathers married the mothers of their children. We want him to strongly support the Marriage Protection Amendment so that we do not have a judiciary forcing on the American people something that clearly two-thirds of the American people don't want, and that is same-sex marriage.
Now, if he doesn't pursue the agenda that you're hoping he will pursue, if he doesn't pursue it vigorously enough to meet your expectations, what do you think the consequences should be?
Well, the consequences will be that he will lose support. You know, I had someone say to me the other day, well, Dr. Land, if the president chooses not to really push for a marriage protection amendment, what's the big deal for the president? I mean, you know, he's already reelected, and where are your people going to go? And I said, well, that's not really the way I'd look at it. I would look at it this way. This president has built up a substantial amount of capital and trust with values voters, with people of traditional religious values, because he has campaigned on and made commitments about issues they care about a great deal. If the president is perceived by those constituencies to be less than enthusiastic in his pursuit of those, then they're going to give him far less benefit of the doubt in supporting him on issues where they're not all that certain that he's right. And my response when asked, what kind of issue are you talking about? Social Security. Reform of Social Security has far less broad support among evangelicals and among traditional Catholics than does opposition to same-sex marriage and being pro-life. But they tend to give this president the benefit of the doubt as long as they see him as strongly committed to and pushing the issues that matter most to them. And to the extent they perceive that he's not, their willingness to go along with him on other issues will lessen, and will lessen rather sharply.
The evangelical groups that are focusing on gay marriage, abortion, have been criticized by some other religious leaders for not focusing on the values of peace and poverty in equal amounts. Mm-hmm. In other words, why is it, for instance, gay marriage that is so high on the agenda as opposed to peace or more jobs or better health care?
Well, first of all, we are accused of focusing on those more than we do because it's all the media ever asks us about.
Let me just stop you and say, when I asked you about the priorities, mm-hmm. you know, you mm-hmm. talked about abortion, gay marriage.
Yeah, but I'm going to talk about some more in just a second. Mm-hmm. First of all, our response is, and it's a response on abortion and gay marriage, is our involvement has been defensive. Abortion on demand was illegal 30 years ago until the Supreme Court, with one fell swoop, struck down all the laws protecting unborn children in this country in the first trimester, and we became one of only 6 countries in the entire world that allows abortion for any reason whatsoever in the third trimester. That's not a list I want to be on as an American. And we are not the ones trying to redefine marriage. It's a court system that has run amok that's trying to redefine marriage. But we're also very much involved in human rights issues. We were very much involved in getting the Sudan Peace Act passed. We were very much involved in getting the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom as part of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed, and getting an accountability from our State Department on the state of play of religious persecution and religious freedom around the world, and have made America the champion of religious freedom around the world. We've also been very influential in getting laws passed against sex trafficking and against human trafficking and against human rights abuses in other parts of the world. So I think it's unfair to say that those are the only two issues. They're very high-profile issues, largely because the secularists in our society don't like our position on those issues. And when it comes to poverty, for instance, I don't know anyone who's pro-poverty. There's a judicial question of prudence between people of religious values on the best way to alleviate poverty in this country. That debate, for instance, took place during the welfare reform legislation. The welfare system we had at the time didn't seem to be doing a very good job of alleviating poverty. It seemed to be perpetuating poverty and creating a semi-permanent underclass. And there are many of us who felt there were better ways to address the issue. That doesn't mean we're not trying to address the issue. And it doesn't mean that we're not doing it through many ministries of our churches.
There is an assumption that some people have that people of faith share a lot of the same political beliefs. But that isn't necessarily true. For example, the war in Iraq, the Bush White House obviously wanted to invade Iraq and pursue the war. The Pope opposed it. So I'm wondering, what you think the Bible or faith, how that informed your decision about what the right policy should be and how you mm-hmm. think it informed the president's.
Well, first of all, I don't think the president wanted to invade Iraq. I think that he came to the conclusion that it was necessary for the best interests of peace in the region and the best interests of protecting the United States to remove Saddam Hussein and his access to weapons of mass destruction and the possibility that the ongoing cooperation between al-Qaeda and Iraq would degenerate into a quid pro quo where weapons of mass destruction were traded for favors and that those weapons of mass destruction would be used against the population of the United States. That's a far thing from wanting to go to war in Iraq. I think he felt that it was the least worst thing that could be done at that time to alleviate a very difficult and dangerous situation. I'm a believer in just war theory. I believe that there are reasons, as Christians over the centuries have believed, that there are times and places and circumstances under which it is permissible to wage for the civil magistrate, for the government to wage war, and there are times when it is not. And to in order for Christians to participate in that warfare, it has to meet all of the just war criteria. I believe that it did meet all of the just war criteria. The Pope didn't. That's a legitimate disagreement. It is true that a lot of religious leaders oppose the war in Iraq, but if you look at the American population, the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops opposed the war, but more than half of Catholics supported it. The mainline churches' leaders opposed the war, but a majority of mainline Protestants supported it. And Southern Baptists supported the president's liberation of Iraq, and the vast majority of Southern Baptists did. I've been asked why it was that as a leader, a religious leader, I supported the liberation of Iraq when so many other religious leaders didn't. And I said, well, it may be because I was democratically elected by my rank and file and they weren't. So I'm more representative of my rank and file.
You said you believe in the just war theory, and one of President Bush's main arguments for invading Iraq was that they had weapons of mass destruction, and this is what our administration argued before the United Nations and told, you know, us, the American citizens. And, you know, now it seems to be conclusive that there were none, at least there were none to be found. So what is the Christian thing for President Bush to tell American citizens now about that premise for the war, which so far has proven to be false?
Well, first of all, it wasn't the only premise for the war, and it wasn't the only premise for the war at the time.
But I understand that. But it was the main one, I think it's fair to say. It was the one that Colin Powell
argued
before the United Nations.
It wasn't to me. It may have been the main one to you. It wasn't to me, and it wasn't to a lot of other Americans. It was certainly a significant factor in the argumentation for the war at that time. But it wasn't the only one. And I do want to make it very clear that I think it is extremely unfair for anyone to say or to think that the president deliberately misled the American people. Everyone thought that Saddam Hussein was in possession of weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, I would rather have a president who errs on the side of caution and a worst-case scenario than one who thinks, well, it's just going to turn out all right, and we end up with we only have to be wrong once for there to be a horrific event in the United States that would make 9/11 pale by comparison.
Just one more thing I wanted to mention, that the Bush administration has told us that it's important to fight terrorists in Iraq so that we don't have to fight them here. Many terrorist experts say that what's happening is that Iraq is becoming a magnet for terrorists, mm-hmm. and also an incentive for people to join terrorist groups.
My response might really be backfiring.
So I'm wondering what, since things haven't happened exactly as planned, I'm wondering what you think the Christian response is from the White House.
Well, the response is not to cut and run. You want us to leave now?
I'm not saying that.
I'm asking you a question. What is your solution, to leave
now? I'm not offering a solution. I was just asking you what you think the right response is for having
the right
arguments.
Response is to continue to do, to is Abraham Lincoln's response. We'll continue with malice toward none, with charity for all. We'll continue to do the right as God gives us the light to see the right. The facts are on the ground that 90% of the Iraqi people, when polled, say they want to have a free government. They want to be governed by Iraqis that they've elected. And the polls also show that if they're allowed to vote without being slaughtered in the street by militant nihilists whose only platform for Iraq is death and destruction, that the Iraqi people want freedom, and we're doing everything we can to help them have the opportunity for freedom. I think that's what America should do. I think that America is acting in its best self when it does that, and that's what the president's going to do. And people may have disagreed about the reasons for going to war. People may have disagreed about whether we should have done it, but we're there now, and as Tony Blair has said, this is a struggle between civilization and barbarism. And if the terrorists are right, that this is a magnet for terrorists around the world, I'd rather be fighting terrorists in Iraq than in New York City or Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles. And guess what? We haven't been attacked since September 11th because the best defense is a good offense.
Why does it seem to you that just because we're fighting terrorists in Iraq, we wouldn't also be fighting at some point terrorists here? Why
Well, if we lose in Iraq and we allow them to drive us out and we allow them to kill all the Iraqis who agreed with us and who support us and who support freedom and democracy, we will fight them here. These people aren't going away. They hate us. They want to destroy us. They want to destroy our influence in the world. They want to put together an Islamic caliphate from Morocco to Indonesia. And if you think that they're going to go away because we weary of seeking to defend freedom and democracy for the Iraqis in Iraq, I can only describe that as a criminal naivete.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Richard Land. He's president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission.
Right. Let me tell you one thing I said in my debate with Jim Wallace at the Brookings Institution earlier this week that's very important. I got up and I started my speech by saying, the fact that you're here at the Brookings Institution and Jim Wallace has written this book and the book has gotten such a strong response demonstrates that we in the so-called religious right have won the debate with secular fundamentalists in this country, that religion should play no role in public policy. I've debated the ACLU in several states where they have said, well, now, Dr. Land, is your opposition to abortion or your opposition to same-sex marriage based upon your religious convictions? And I said, well, yes, it is. And they said, with a very smug smile on their face, well, of course, you know, we can't make public policy in this country based upon religious convictions. That argument, which has held sway for 30 years, has now been lost. I don't know if y'all have picked it up yet at NPR, but it was lost. Americans want moral values to have a say in public policy. Now, I'm going to have a debate with Jim Wallace and people like Jim Wallace, and we're going to have some significant disagreements about where religious conviction would take us and what the hierarchy of moral values are. But that's a very different discussion than the one I've been having with Barry Lynn and the ACLU, where they say, if your beliefs are based upon religious convictions, your moral values are based upon religious convictions, you're disqualified from putting on a uniform and playing in the game. No, we're not. And the majority of the American people now understand that. And I relish a dialogue and a debate about the best way to apply religious convictions as they translate into moral values in public policy. And if all of us bring our moral convictions to bear, whether they're religiously based or not, on public policy, it'll make Republicans better Republicans and Democrats better Democrats and the country a better country.
I heard several people before the election predict that if Bush won for a second term, that there would be a civil war within the Republican Party between moderates and fundamentalists, between pragmatists and true believers. We're about to start that second term.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I think that's wishful thinking on the part of people who hope it's true. Of course not. That's not going to happen. The Republican Party is a party of traditional religious values and of cultural conservatism. And there are a few, vestigial relics like Arlen Specter and former Governor Whitman around, but they're clearly in a minority, and they're going to stay in a minority. And let me bring some really bad news to some of your listeners. The next Republican nominee for president will look an awful lot like George W. Bush, because George W. Bush is the product of long-term cultural and historic forces. The real civil war is going to be in the Democrat Party, between the Deniacs and the secular fundamentalists on the one side and people like Jim Wallace who want to reinsert religiously informed moral values into public policy.
By the way, the two people who I was referring to in talking about a civil war within the Republican Party, one was Patrick Buchanan, and the mm-hmm. other was Bruce Bartlett, who was in the Reagan White House.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't Democrats saying that, it was Republicans.
Well,
though,
it still may have been wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. this debate is over in the Republican Party, state by state, which makes up the 50 states of the Republican Party. And, if a social moderate and economic and foreign policy conservative wants to run for president in 2008, Fine, let them. They won't win a primary west of the Hudson.
Dr. Lynn, you are head of what is basically the lobbying arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. Did you always feel that your faith could connect to politics, or did you arrive at that connection later in life?
Well, first of all, we don't lobby. We engage in public policy education and public policy advocacy, and we've won a court case in Washington, D.C. that proves that. We engage in public policy, and I came to this fairly early in my religious experience. I surrendered to full-time ministry when I was 16. Martin Luther King Jr. is a personal hero of mine. He models for me what it means as a Baptist minister to bring your faith into critique of society and to right wrongs and to address evil in society. And that was furthered by my exposure to Francis Schaeffer, whose central tenet was truth is truth with a capital T, and if it's true at home, it's true in the world. If it's true at church, it's true in government. And you have an obligation to be salt and light in the world and to speak truth to power in all places, in all times.
Dr. Lynn, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard Land is the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is the policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention.